This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, we'll look at the ceasefire agreement that was signed today by warring rebel groups in the West African country of Liberia. As part of the agreement, Liberian President Charles Taylor says he will step down. We'll talk about what all of this means for the future of the war-torn country, the oldest republic in Africa, and the prospects for lasting peace. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Yesterday, 12 people were released from prisons in Texas after being wrongly convicted in a series of notorious drug cases in Tulia, Texas. Back in July of 1999, 46 people were arrested, most of them African-American, after an 18-month undercover operation. They were later convicted. Some received very long sentences. The agent in charge of the investigation has been discredited because he presented no real evidence in the original trial. Joining us now to talk about what happened in a case that divided the small Texas town of 5,000 people is the director of the Tulia Legal Defense Project, Jeff Blackburn, a defense and civil rights attorney. He's with us from his office in Amarillo, Texas. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Can you give us a brief description of this case?
Sure. About 4 years ago, a huge sweep was conducted of this tiny town called Tulia. Tulia is located pretty much in the middle of nowhere in the Panhandle region of Texas. It's a small farming community with about 5,000 people in it. The sweep, which netted, got them 46 people based on 132 different charges, all of which were alleged drug deals that were done between folks and an undercover agent named Tom Coleman. Now, it was very interesting at the time. If we were to go back in time, what we would have seen was a community frenzy around this, a huge outpouring of community support for law enforcement, a lot of really over-the-top statements made by the DA, the sheriff's office, and the rest, lauding this undercover cop as a great hero, proclaiming that Tulia had apparently suffered from a very serious drug problem, and I guess had become, in some ways, and they said this was a hub of drug dealing for the entire Panhandle region.
Mm-hmm.
These folks were kept in jail. They had very high bond set. Nearly all of them were very, very poor. Again, mostly African American. They began to get run through the infamous Texas criminal justice system. And what that means down here is that you get a court-appointed lawyer. We don't have a public defender system. We have a crony appointment system where the judge, who incidentally is also an elected official, decides who your lawyer is going to be. They had really bad ones in this case. In fact, with almost without exception, these lawyers turned in a terrible job, did no investigation of any kind. Many of them would show up on the day of trial having never met their client before that day.
Well, one of the things that intrigues me, though, is when Tom Coleman, who was the agent who conducted these undercover investigations, when he couldn't present video evidence or audio evidence or the drugs or the money, wasn't the jury skeptical?
Well, the problem that we have here, Neil, is there are a couple of them. First of all, there's no requirement in Texas law, not yet anyway, that the word of an undercover cop like this be corroborated by any extrinsic evidence of any kind. I mean, no photographs are required, no marked money is required, and so forth. So, you know, they had the bare minimum here, which was just the cop saying, oh, yeah, it happened, and you should believe me that it did.
Hmm.
That was enough. And it was surely enough for these jurors who, I mean, really, what they were confronted with was a simple choice. I mean, do you believe the cop or not? The arguments that were made to them were, if you don't believe this officer, then you don't believe in law enforcement, you don't believe our local sheriff, and so forth. These were very crude, simplistic trials. Most of them lasted about a day. It was a real Scottsboro kind of phenomenon going on down here.
Now, how did it start to come unraveled?
Well, one of the court-appointed lawyers, a fellow named Van Williamson, and I mention his name because his client got railroaded along with the others, but he did a good thing. He did a very strong thing. He was upset by what had happened, concerned about it, and in fact really was just about the only lawyer that was that way. He came to me. I'm a lawyer here in Amarillo, Texas. I've been known to do civil rights cases before, and I've been known to do criminal defense work and make a living doing that sort of thing. I began to look at these cases independently. I ordered some transcripts. I started reading the trial records that had gone on, and a lot of things jumped out at us as being really, really problematic. once we figured out, and then I also got an investigator to dig up some background on this agent. What I found out was absolutely shocking. This guy was the biggest zero in law enforcement that I've ever encountered in my 20 years of practicing law. He'd been essentially run out of every department he'd been in before he had brushes with the law himself. While he was a deputy. And lots of things to suggest that he was not believable. The more we looked at the cases, we realized there were big discrepancies. Little facts began to appear to us quite clearly. Like, for example, he'd say on timesheets that he was at such and such location at such and such a day. Then, in his reports that he was supposedly making concerning these arrests, he would be someplace else on that day. There were discrepancies like that. Then as we dug through the reports that he had made, we got records from the clerk's office, we began to find out that he had also clearly tampered with some of the government records. For example, in one of them he had a report that said he had gotten drugs from a woman that was 6 months pregnant. He later found out after they arrested her that she had never been pregnant. She weighed about 110 pounds. So that's no problem. We just take a magic marker and mark out the 6 months pregnant part of the report.
Well, to make a long story short, eventually this all came unglued. And yesterday, at least some of the people involved were released from prison.
That's right. Now, their release, and this is most, I think the most significant thing that I think people need to understand out there. This release is a real stopgap measure. This is not the end of the case. This is not the end of the story. This just gets them reunited with their families until we can either convince the Board of Pardons and Paroles to overturn all these cases, which we believe we're going to do, or we convince the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals to order new trials in all these cases, which is all they can do legally with the process that we've invoked, the writ of habeas corpus. So without getting too technical, what I want folks to understand is the bail hearing yesterday was powerful symbolism, yet not really all that important to us legally. Legally, we still have a long road to hoe. We're working hard on it, and we're going to keep at it.
A long road. It could take a couple of years, is what I read.
A couple of years in the court system. I'm much more optimistic about our chances with the Board of Pardons and Paroles and the governor's office. Something. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. So, in that case, how long do you think it might take in that event?
I am willing to get my comfort level around the idea that that by the end of this summer we're going to get an across the board pardon for everybody that was victimized by this rogue cop, this liar, who incidentally was not. You know, he didn't act alone. He was put up to do what he did by the numbers-driven law enforcement game that we have in Texas, a task force that employed him, and his perjury was suborned and put before the jury by the district attorney, and I think also knowingly allowed by the judge. We've developed a very shocking, horrible picture of how justice can go wrong in the state of Texas in this case.
Well, thanks very much for telling us some about it.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Jeff Blackburn is a defense and civil rights lawyer, pro bono, and director of the Tulia Legal Defense Project. He is currently representing 38 of the Tulia defendants as they strive to overturn their convictions, and he joined us from his office in Amarillo, Texas. And here are some of the headlines from NPR News today. In Congress, Democrats are pressing for more details about how the Bush administration made its argument for going to war with Iraq. Michigan Senator Carl Levin says the CIA has information that would prove the U.S. withheld key facts about Iraq's weapons. More on that in a few moments, and more on that later today from NPR's David Wellna at the Capitol. Meantime, in Iraq, U.S. troops and the U.S. civil administration there are still struggling to impose the rule of law. Attacks against troops are occurring daily. NPR's Eric Westervelt will have an update. You can hear those stories later on All Things Considered. Right now, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. The issue of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction is coming to dominate Congress, Parliament in Britain, and there are strong statements today on the issue from President Bush. The president spoke today at a Virginia community college and responded to critics who said that his administration inflated the threat of WMDs to establish a rationale for war.
We made it clear to the dictator of Iraq that he must disarm. We asked other nations to join us in saying to it that he would disarm, and he chose not to do so, so we disarmed him. And I know there's a lot of revisionist history now going on, but one thing is certain, he is no longer a threat to the free world, and the people of Iraq are free.
The discussion tomorrow moves to Capitol Hill. Both the House and Senate Intelligence Committees begin reviews on how intelligence on Iraq's weapons was put together. Earlier today on NPR's Morning Edition, Senator Carl Levin, a Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, explained why he wants CIA Director George Tenet to declassify documents regarding suspected Iraqi weapon sites.
Well, we asked George Tenet, the head of the CIA, on a number of occasions publicly whether or not all of the significant weapons of mass destruction suspect sites had been shared with the UN inspectors. And he twice told us publicly that all of the significant sites had been shared with the UN inspectors. I challenged that publicly at the time back in February because the classified material showed that, as a matter of fact, a lot of the sites had not been shared with the inspectors. And we've had a ongoing battle over this ever since, and it is now clearly opportune to make public the actual figures, the actual numbers of suspect sites which have been shared, which he withheld from the public at that time.
Carl Levin of Michigan, the senior Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee. And in London today, a parliamentary inquiry got underway into the British government's justification for launching a war with Iraq. Former Foreign Secretary Robin Cook appeared as the first witness at a House of Commons look into whether the threat posed by Saddam Hussein was exaggerated. Here is Cook responding to a question posed by the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, Donald Anderson, about the quality of Iraqi intelligence.
I actually have no doubt about the good faith of the Prime Minister and others who engaged in this exercise. If anything, I think perhaps the problem was the burning sincerity and conviction of those who were involved in the exercise. Intelligence, one should understand, it comes in an enormous broad range. It's a bit like an alphabet soup. You get all the letters of the alphabet. You can try there by studying it carefully to try and come up with a coherent statement. I fear on this occasion what happened was that those bits of the alphabet that supported the case were selected. Now, that's not deceit, it's not invention, it is not coming up with intelligence that didn't exist, but it was not presenting the whole picture. And I fear the fundamental problem is that instead of using intelligence as evidence on which to base a conclusion about policy, we used intelligence as the basis in which we could justify a policy in which we'd already settled.
So the burning conviction led to a distortion of the evidence?
I would not be. I think it would be probably fair to say that there was a selection of evidence to support the conclusion rather than a conclusion that arose from a full consideration of the evidence.
We'll have more on the debate over weapons of mass destruction on Talk of the Nation in the days and weeks ahead. Talk of the Nation is produced by Susan Lund, Setsuko Sato, Justine Kennan, and Alicia Montgomery. Our director is Chad Campbell, the production assistant is Brendan Banizak, and our intern is Amelia Shaw. The technical director for Talk of the Nation is Michael Cullen. He gets help this week from Vince Muse, Art Laurent, Stacey Abbott, Mitch Eaton, and Ivan Berketh. The senior editor of the program is Ellen Silva. The senior producer is Sue Goodwin. And Leith Bishop is the executive producer of Talk of the Nation. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.